It is a great pleasure to introduce our next instructor based in London. Mark Walker serves as managing partner of Tollymore Investment Partners, a private investment partnership for long-term investors. Previously, Mark was a global equity investor at Seven Pillars Capital Management, a long-term value-oriented investment firm also based in London. Mark has 15 years of investment research and financial analysis experience. He joined Seven Pillars from RWC Partners, where he was part of a two-person team managing a long-term global equity fund. Prior to that, Mark was worked as an investment research analyst on the sell side for Goldman Sachs and Redburn Partners. I want to draw your attention to Mark's past presentations at our online conferences, which have been very well researched and well received, and also his wonderful articles on investment process and execution versus philosophy. Those are available on the MOI Global website. And now, on behalf of the MOI Global membership community, a very warm welcome to you, Mark. Please go ahead.
Hi, John. Thanks for the kind introduction. It's a pleasure to be presenting again at Best Ideas 2019. I recently launched Tollymore, and this is my first presentation to the MOI Global community in that capacity. So I thought it worthwhile to just very briefly outline Tollymore's investment philosophy, just to provide the audience a context with which to judge the investment idea that we'll go through. So Tollymore Investment Partners is a private investment partnership investing in a small number of what we consider to be exceptional publicly listed businesses in order to compound partners' capital over the long term. As you mentioned, I have a number of years' experience in investment research. Prior to founding Tollymore, I was 5 years on the buy side as a generalist long-term global investment manager, and then 5 years on the sell side. There are four key principles which really govern Tollymore's investment philosophy. And the first is a long-term investment horizon. We think that in the short term, there can often be a very low correlation between stock and business success. But over the long term, that correlation is high. And in my view, discipline and patience are sort of key ingredients that will help us to exploit those price value discrepancies. And our efforts are mainly focused on finding companies that are capable of both preserving and increasing their intrinsic values through their own efforts. And what we're really trying to do as long-term investors here is to exploit a time arbitrage afforded to patient investors with patient capital. The approach is kind of what I refer to as value-oriented. Value is obviously defined in many different ways throughout this community, but we tend to apply a private business owner mentality to listed equities. And as I said, we're focusing on maximizing the intrinsic value of the portfolio. That includes employing a very demanding price discipline and trying to identify those companies that can increase their own values. The portfolios are concentrated. We think that excessive diversification prohibits the ability to carry out the due diligence required to think like business owners, and therefore to know how to act, what to do when the quoted market price of the individual securities changes. Clearly concentrated portfolios might well be more volatile than the market or more diversified, actively managed peers. But again, what we're trying to do is collect a number of investors who share our view that short-term performance is just not relevant in the long-term accumulation of wealth. Another corollary of that is that we are benchmark agnostic. We don't think that a business owner mindset is necessarily consistent with taking a market view. Volatility can actually help us as public equity investors. It can provide an opportunity to purchase assets at a discount to what they're worth. we don't consider risk as volatility, but the capacity to lose capital permanently. And for us, margin of safety is found primarily in the business and management quality of the underlying holdings. We concentrate our research efforts on finding companies with strong balance sheets, with companies that can preserve and grow their private business value and are hopefully trading at large discounts to that intrinsic value or to that capacity to grow that intrinsic value. That is to say that investment merits are typically assessed in the context of capital structure risk, business value, impairment risk, and valuation risk. So what are the sort of principles of a process that we think is consistent with our philosophy? Well, you know, a sensible long-term business owner investment philosophy is not of much use if the investing ecosystem doesn't allow us to faithfully execute a consistent investment process. And for us, the key aspects of that really govern idea generation, investment research, and portfolio management. And overarching all those pillars is the belief that execution is everything. You know, we've tried to construct a low-key physical working environment free from distraction, and that I think is conducive to independent thinking. And you know, in the early days of Tolly Moore, I'm working very hard to make sure that the investment philosophy and the investor base are matched to my temperament as an investment manager. Ideas are typically not generated according to a systematic magic formula. You know, as I said, we have concentrated portfolios and a global investment remit. Therefore, our challenge is really rejecting the vast majority of mediocre investment opportunities that cross our path. Research process is bottom up, one company at a time. We are searching for competitively very strong businesses, which ideally have avenues for profitable redeployment of capital for a long time, and whose capital structures is conservative or at least appropriate for the business model, and whose management teams are incentivized to make the capital allocation decisions that will create the most long-term value for owners. Regards portfolio management, by owning this type of portfolio of businesses that are steadily compounding their own per share economic earnings, we think that that really tips the odds of earning a satisfactory equity return in our favor. And one of the great advantages of being a public equity investor versus our sort of private market peers is that we are in a position to exploit stock market volatility to hopefully improve upon the underlying business value compounding. The environment, as I mentioned, we're trying to make good decisions, and we're trying to make good decisions consistently. And really, that requires a physical working environment that allows us to devote brain power to those decisions and not to battling distraction. What this all means is that really the source of a competitive advantage in which we believe is really behavioral. You know, in the pursuit of a goal to create value for our investors, we take care not to take the ability to make good decisions for granted. But typically that requires you know, inaction. It requires solitude. It requires being epistemically humble and patient. And I think that those are luxurious qualities that certainly that I've seen over my career are not typically found within the constraints of large institutional money managers. So just as we move on to the idea, I'd like to introduce the investment idea by encouraging viewers to think about what they might be willing to pay to own a privately held company with the following economic characteristics. So this company is a very simple business. It's a founder-led business. It's a provider of an enduring service, reflecting a business practice which is hundreds of years old with a high utility to cost ratio for its customers. It is geographically and industrially diversified. It is headquartered in the UK. Capital intensity of the business is typically less than 2% of revenues. Free cash flow conversion of earnings is very strong, in part aided by deferred income balances, which have ranged between 50 and 70% of annual sales. The average three-cycle returns on capital of the business is around 30%, and that has been facilitated by a defensible moat, which is predominantly provided by two-sided network effects, barriers to entry. Revenue visibility is high. Around two-thirds of next year's sales are typically forward booked. The capital structure of the business is conservative and certainly appropriate, in my view, for the business model. And organic revenue growth is currently around 11%. So the company is London listed ITE Group. And what does ITE do? Well, it's involved in just one business activity. It organizes exhibitions and conferences globally. The business, the nuts and bolts of the businesses are really about hiring venues and gathering a group of exhibitors and visitors, monetizing typically the exhibitor side of the network by charging companies for floor space. The company operates across several sectors, including construction, food, energy, travel and tourism in predominantly emerging market geographies. It's very labor intensive, but very capital light business model. Venue hire and staff are around 3/4 of the cost of organizing a typical event. So the end markets are, as you can see, they are cyclical, but very diversified. While multi-year agreements can be struck to secure venue capacity, these agreements typically have the flexibility to modify capacity commitments ahead of changes in demand. And as mentioned, there's good visibility on revenues thanks to forward bookings. The operating margins of the business have been reasonably stable thanks to the moderate operating leverage that you can see here in the typical cost of organizing an event. I think the current levels of operating profitability are around 22%. That is around 5 percentage points below mid-cycle levels. And some of that margin runoff, we'll discuss this a bit later, but some of that margin runoff has come as a result of deferred revenue increases. So exhibitors are securing their participation at future events at more competitive rates. So what therefore may be surrendered in terms of income statement profitability is then recovered by working capital inflows and free cash flow conversion. Now, despite that, and again, as we will discuss when we talk about management and what they've been doing for the business, management team has a plan to restore the business to operating margins in the high 20s. ITE, I think, is appropriately capitalized business given this high revenue visibility, given strong repeat business, and given multi-year agreements with their vendors. Despite around £50 million of debt-funded M&A in FY18, and net debt is around £80 million, which is around 1.4 times EBITDA, around 2 years of free cash flow, and about a quarter of ITE's equity. The deferred revenue comes because revenue is recognized at the completion of an event, but cash is received from the exhibitors in advance and booked as deferred revenue. That's essentially a costless source of finance for ITE and represents a working capital inflow when revenues are growing, but obviously a drag when on free cash flow when revenues decline as they did a few years ago. This deferred income flow has typically been in the past 40 to 50% of sales, but the founder of the business left the business and has since returned a CEO, and he one of the things he's done is grown that deferred revenue float to 2/3 of annual sales, strengthening the cash conversion of the business. So the main point of it, main evidence, I think, that supports the existence of an economic moat is a long track record of supernormal profits, and that seems to emanate essentially from two sources of competitive advantage. One is that network effects. Visitors are needed in order to attract exhibitors and vice versa, making it very difficult for non-established players to gain traction. And the second is intangible assets in the form of trademarks and licenses to operate venues, databases of consumers, and brand reputation, all of which makes participants reluctant to move away from tried and tested events. Pricing power, I think, is facilitated by the fees charged to exhibitors, representing fairly low levels of their costs of running their businesses. And then as it relates to supplier power, venue homogeneity, an IT's position as the anchor tenant with many venues makes that somewhat limited. ITE's fares have sort of continued to grow despite, and indeed global industry, the global conferences industry has continued to grow steadily despite sort of VoIP and video conferencing dramatically lowering the cost of some forms of global communication. And so I think there's some elements of IT's business model that are clearly very enduring. Thinking about the IT's competition, IT typically competes with small mom-and-pop individual trade shows. To the extent that they compete with larger global players, there's a tends to be a niche geographic or sectoral focus of those players. So IT sort of focuses on construction, energy, food and tourism. Some of the larger competitors have their own niche sector focuses. Tarsus is a competitor that's very focused on the medical sector. UBM is a large competitor, but typically competes in the US and China in sectors such as fashion and jewelry. Then there are certain very geographically limited operators. MCH is Swiss only, Fiera Milano is Italy only, and so forth. The key element to think about this this value chain is that this sort of concept of symbiosis within the value chain. Customers in this industry do not want more choice. They do not want competing trade shows. They want to know that their customers are going to be at the event that they are attending that year, or the event they are attending once every 2 years. So that's a form of efficient scale where there's only really space for a handful of profitable operators within each region and industry niche. Thinking about the growth opportunity, the avenues for profitable redeployment of capital, I've classified this business as a legacy moat business rather than a reinvestment moat or a capital light compounder. And that's really due to the lack of greenfield organic opportunities to build new exhibitions around the world. However, having said that, ITE does have a strong foothold in several emerging markets, including India, China. ITE has established market-leading positions either through fully owned subsidiaries and controlling interests in locally dominant exhibitions brands, as well as JV partners. It has a controlling stake in the market-leading conferences business, ABEC in India, which runs around 20-25 exhibitions across the country. It has ITE's offices in Beijing, China, and it operates that operation through a JV with Hong Kong-based Sinostar. It also runs conferences across Indonesia via JV partnerships and wholly owned subsidiaries. And the as you can see in the chart here, the organic growth trajectory has inflected positively in the business. I think that that is partly due to the economic stabilization. Again, we'll discuss what's been sort of happening in terms of macro and geopolitical events and some of IT's end markets. So it's partly due to that stabilization, and partly due to a business improvement program that's put in place since the founder of the business has returned to ITE in 2016. So a series of these macroeconomic shocks have really beset ITE's end markets and impeded the business's progress in the sort of 3 or 4 years prior to 2017. And they range from the Russia-Crimea crisis and resulting trade sanctions at a time when Russia was a much larger part of ITE's business. It included a 70% collapse in the price of oil, which harmed business in ITE's energy-dependent Central Asian markets. I think that the improvement that you're currently seeing in top-line growth, top-line organic growth, should really bode well for the capacity of the business to really meaningfully increase underlying cash generation, especially given the strides management's making, collecting cash for conference pre-bookings. And as we'll discuss shortly, the market implies that really the exact opposite will happen, that the sustainable cash the business can generate will really wither significantly. And the stock has just continued to move in the opposite direction to the business's progress. It's worth mentioning that given this classification as a legacy mode business and the cash generation capacity of the business, there is an opportunistic M&A agenda in place. There are limited opportunities to build new shows from the ground organically. M&A will always be a part of management capital allocation agenda. So therefore, it's important to really understand the management team, their track record, and their incentives for allocating capital. The founder of the business, Mark Sashua, has returned to ITE with a plan to improve the organic growth potential and profitability of the current portfolio. And what he's doing is divesting of the least profitable subscale events. And this is a playbook that he's executed at his previous company he ran, which is called I2I Events. And that business, under his leadership over a 5-year period, enjoyed a doubling of revenues and profits before being acquired by a company called Essential Events. So Mark founded ITE in 1991. He left the business and was the CEO of a number of other companies, and he's since returned in 2016 to the business. This year, 2018, ITE announced the acquisition of Essential Events based on an enterprise value of £300 million. The target assets comprise two global exhibition brands, and a number of UK exhibition brands across a range of sectors. The CEO and the COO of ITE Group are very familiar with these assets. They ran them together between 2011 and 2016 as the CEO and the CFO. And they described the rationale in terms of both top-line growth potential and some operating synergies. So relating to growth potential, the graphic here shows is from the presentation materials relating to the acquisition, and it clearly implies that the ITE management believe these assets have been mismanaged, resulting in suboptimal revenue growth. So you can see here the deliverable that the current ITE management achieved when they were managing these assets. They have since been acquired by a business for various reasons. Now treat the essential assets as non-core. And so the business performance as it relates to cash conversion, retention, revenue growth have deteriorated over time. And relating to operating synergies, IT is implementing an integration plan that seeks to eliminate obvious sources of cost duplication and generate cost savings from economies of scale. The acquisition will also reduce the Russian exposure. This is not a rationale explained by management for the deal, but the Russian exposure of the business will go down from around half of revenues to around a quarter. Management incentives have improved modestly with the management change, and I think are reasonable but not standout. Base salaries for the CEO and CFO are sort of low to mid six-figure numbers, and bonuses are a function of pre-tax earnings, organic revenue growth, cash conversion, and some qualitative targets. And the LTIP is a function of earnings per share and relative TSR. What I think is interesting is the targets that are in place under the current LTIP. So ITE's earnings per share need to grow by 75% over the next 2 years for any of the LTIP to vest. And for 100% of the LTIP to pay out, ITE needs to generate earnings per share of 14.4p by September 2020, which is almost treble their recently reported FY18 EPS, and it's around around a 25% yield to the current share price. All these measures were only introduced in 2017, and you know, while I think that the cash conversion in particular is a sensible target, some measure of returns on capital I think would be a welcome addition to the incentive program, given the high cash generation of the business and as I mentioned, limited obvious long-term redeployment opportunities. Minimum shareholding requirements are, again, reasonable, not standout. They're 2x base salary, but insider ownership is pretty modest given the short tenures of the management team. I would say that, kind of to summarize the sort of stewardship of the business, like the track record of the new leadership and some of the incentive framework progression, I think those two things are improving the stewardship of a demonstrably wide moat business. But a wide moat business that suffered some sort of macro headwinds that have been showing signs of dissipating. I don't think this is a turnaround thesis. I think this is already, you know, a fantastic, highly profitable business, but one that can benefit from this macro mean reversion in end markets, one that can benefit from structural portfolio improvement driven by this positive management change, and then potentially a re-rating of the shares to reflect those former drivers, which we'll discuss further when we get on to valuation. So as I mentioned, so ITE has announced this, you know, has completed this acquisition of Essential. That was a $300 million enterprise value and funded predominantly by a rights issue. Principal risk, therefore, I think, is that shareholders are being tapped to fund empire building of this business. Management equity interests, unfortunately, are just not sufficient to act as any kind of material safeguard against this risk. However, as you can see from this chart, there's been some asset rightsizing throughout the CEO's tenure, which I think it's logical to assume that mitigates the risk somewhat. And additionally, the CEO, COO, and actually a couple of other senior executives at ITE are very familiar with the assets they've acquired, and because they ran them all together for 5 years. Looking at how the stock has performed, the share price has collapsed since 2014 due to the series of sort of geopolitical events, including Russia, Crimea, the oil price collapse, the ruble depreciation. So that accounts for the performance up until the change in management, up until 2017. But over the last year or so, the share price has fallen by another 50%. And I think that more recent selling has in part been due to non-fundamental pressure, selling pressure, as the portfolio has become much less emerging market focused, and therefore the company's stock price has really moved in the opposite direction to the business's performance, which is the business has shown a stabilization of profit margins. It's shown a sharp inflection in organic revenue growth and some qualitative improvements in management and stewardship. This is a company that doesn't really screen very well. ITE's cash flow and owner earnings are materially higher than reported earnings per share due to the large deferred revenue float and due to impairments of the prior management capital allocation decisions and due to the amortization of what are really quasi-permanent assets such as customer relationships and internally developed brands. So therefore, it's important to keep those things in mind when having a view as to what the sort of normal free cash flow generation of the business is. Adjusting for some of the one-off costs associated with the business improvement program and adjusting for biennial events, those events that don't reoccur every year, the sort of trailing 12-month free cash flow of the business is around £30 million. That's around 25% of IT's equity and debt funding, and it's almost 20% of the core group revenues. That is excluding the small contribution that Essential Acquisition has made this year. That's for a business running with organic revenue growth in the double digits. So that's what the business is generating. How is the market pricing that? Current market cap is around 420 million. Share price is around 58p today. Now that 420 million market cap accounts for the rights issue funded acquisition of Essential completed in the summer. That rights issue was £265 million. So what that really implies is that the market is valuing ITE's pre-acquisition cash flows at a 19% yield. That implies implies one or a combination of three things. And it implies material free cash erosion in the core business, or zero or even negative free cash margins in the newly acquired assets that ITE management is implying is under earning, or it implies that ITE is massively overpaid for Essential. Do the data or the evidence or logic support any of those things? Well, the core business is recording 11% organic revenue growth, and the acquired assets are generating 31% EBITDA margins. And capital intensity is around 1%. So I think it's very unlikely that that's a free cash flow negative business. So did ITE overpay for the deal? Well, they believe they're paying 11.5 times EBITDA for an ungeared business that can grow revenues double digits. That seems reasonable. In the case of zero revenue or cost synergies they refer to, they're paying 12.5 times EBITDA. Again, for businesses, high quality businesses, very high barriers to entry and capital intensity of typically 1%. I don't think that is expensive. I think it may be the case that ITE is a better owner of this business than the seller, because for them it is a core asset versus non-core for the vendor. I think that is not a terribly contentious argument. It's very consistent with the comments that Essential have made about the deal. It's very consistent with Mark Sacher's comments to me actually before the acquisition, when we were talking about various competitors an essential, not typically being considered a strong competitor. The company focuses on its non-events business, essentially a data and analytics business. So I just think that the market is not paying attention. I've spoken with some of the large institutional owners of the shares appearing near the top of the register. For them, ITE is a small part of a very diversified portfolio. And I think that in certain cases, their understanding of the deal and appreciation of management's prior history with the assets reflected that. So what is ITE worth? Well, I think that a very conservative appraisal of a private business value would imply north of 70% upside to the current price. We would get there by capitalizing the trailing free cash generation of the core business at a 6% rate. That is a 4% growth rate, and which is what which is the global industry is growing revenues organically at 4-5% a year. And so you would assume that ITE's sustainable free cash flow growth is actually lower than the industry's revenue growth. If you assume that the essential acquisition was value neutral, you would then add the rights issue capital to that number, which would get you to an owner's value of around 750 to 800 million pounds. As I said, the global industry is projected to grow at 5% a year, and many of ITE's markets are expected to grow high single digit. So I think this is fairly conservative. It would also imply that management miss their own goals and LTIP targets substantially, as previously discussed. Management is targeting and is actually overachieving a high single-digit revenue growth. They're targeting margin expansion, and they're targeting and putting in place measures to ensure large working capital inflows. Those drivers would then result in free cash flow compounding of around 1.5 times revenue growth. So in conclusion, I think that as it relates to the deal, ultimately there are a number of senior people at ITE who previously ran these assets for several years. They're paying a no growth multiple for high quality assets, yet they have a track record of growing those same assets double digits. They have a track record, albeit short, of turning ITE from negative organic growth to plus 11% since they arrived. I think that empire risk is mitigated by reasonable management incentives and a history of less profitable asset disposals and the familiarity with the assets they intend to incorporate into the core business. So from an economic value added perspective, I think that the EVA that can be created in this business post the deal seems to me to be larger than before the deal, because the assets to which the returns improvement from the business improvement program can be applied have just increased meaningfully. Additionally, there may be non-fundamental benefits to the share price in the form of better liquidity, better shareholder communication, and a larger market cap leading to broader analyst coverage. But mainly the investment merits of this business can really just be summed up by saying that ITE is a very good and very cheap company. Thank you for your time, John, and happy to take any questions.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for such a comprehensive presentation. Maybe just to follow up on the management incentives, I think you mentioned that the founder no longer owns a significant amount of stock.
Yeah, that's right. He doesn't. He sold his equity when he left the business, and he's since been acquiring shares since he arrived, but he's not a material owner.
Oh, but he has been a buyer of the stock in the open market,
Yes, he's been buying the stock in the open market, but I wouldn't say considerable level. I think that he will, easily surpass his 2x base salary holding requirement. But he's not, he won't appear on the register for quite some time.
And if we could just talk a little bit more about the Russia portion of revenue, is that do we know the profitability of that piece, and do you see any hidden risks there at all?
Yeah, so the profitability recently is actually above the overall group level of profitability. And there's been most of their business, vast majority of their Russian business is Moscow. That business has fully rebounded to very profitable levels. Some of the other exhibitions they run outside of Moscow are still lagging Moscow somewhat. The prospects for their markets in which they've experienced depressed conditions are not really based on any kind of macro forecasting other than the observation that they are currently at below through cycle levels. Their exposure to Russia, as I said, is now kind of around 25% of the business. I would consider that a directional positive, whereas it's actually triggered a lot of selling because of emerging market funds who can no longer own the stock.
And Mark, going forward, what would be the key data points to keep an eye on to either validate or challenge your thesis?
Yeah, so I think that capital allocation is one. I think that so far there has been evidence that empire building risk is mitigated. The biggest acquisition they've made by a mile is Essential Events, and I think that what they paid for that was reasonable. I think it was a unique circumstance that they know these assets inside out. I think that there is evidence that, again, they are under-earning assets that can be improved from already like decently performing level. And they've obviously shrunk the portfolio materially. They've divested of a number of events without really taking not really taking much off the EBITDA at all of the company. But if you saw that the most of the cash generation of the business was used to support the inorganic revenue of the company at acquisition multiples that implied broadly above industry growth levels, that would be a red flag in terms of capital allocation. In terms of the businesses, I'd like to see management continue to build up their equity interest in the company. I'd also like them to improve their incentive framework by introducing ideally incremental cash returns on capital metrics into their incentive framework. In terms of the business's progress, the organic management have quite clear targets for the organic revenue growth potential of the business. That is high single digit, and they're currently generating double digit. So if the organic growth of the business suddenly started to deteriorate meaningfully below that level, that would be not consistent with their view that this is a business with very high levels of revenue visibility. And then the margin potential, the margins of the business have stabilized. I would expect to see a number of the costs that I've taken out of the normalized free cash flow number as relating to the business improvement program to disappear, not entirely next year, but entirely by the year after. If we see some recurring, non-recurring items, then that would cause me to reevaluate downward my view of the sustainable free cash flow generation of the business as well. Having said all of that, the valuation of the business is at a level which implies, in my view, free cash flow erosion. So I think that the margin of safety provided by the entry price is really quite significant here. I think you've got a business where the business risk is mitigated by the high barriers to entry. I think the valuation risk is mitigated by, you know, a 19% free cash flow yield. And I think that balance sheet risk is mitigated by high levels of revenue visibility and a net debt level, which is a couple of years consumed by free cash flow.
And just to clarify on the 19% free cash flow yield, is that on the entire enterprise or is that excluding the acquired piece?
That's excluding. So what that does is take it is the free cash flow, the normal free cash flow of the core business, and it divides that by the current market cap adjusted for the rights issue. So I've taken out of the free cash. So basically Essential has been in IT's financials for 2.5 months of FY18, the year to September 2018. And so I've removed an estimated free cash flow contribution from the Essential events. And that's why I'm saying that the valuation implies either that core free cash flow, which is a 19% yield to the rights issue adjusted market cap, is going to materially erode, or they've just acquired a business that is going to negatively contribute to free cash flow, to the combined free cash flow of the business, and will go down, or they have overpaid materially for the essential assets. And, you know, I've discussed why I don't think that is an obvious conclusion.
And Mark, how cyclical is this business?
So the end markets are cyclical end markets. They are, they're in these clearly very cyclical sectors, but they're very diversified. IT is very diversified in terms of sector and also in terms of geography. So the result is that actually, the revenue visibility, the revenue volatility is dampened somewhat by that geography and industry diversification. The low operating leverage of the business and the modest financial leverage of the business means that the profitability margins are actually fairly stable over time for the business. Operating margins have sort of run low 20s to the high 20s, and we're currently at the low 20s right now. Now, free cash flow volatility will then be higher than operating profitability volatility because of the significant negative working capital influence as it relates to whether our organic revenue is growing or declining.
Thank you, Mark. I'll leave it there. Really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. And I would just encourage our members to either follow up with you directly with their own thoughts and questions, or to contact us, and we will be happy to facilitate an introduction. And I see here on the last slide, you are showing your contact information as well. So thank you very much, Mark.
My pleasure, John. Take care.
Goodbye for now.